Before we get into today's podcast about the never-ending story, I want to take a quick second to thank our friends over at TrueCar. 60 seconds. That's exactly how long this commercial lasts. You know what else you can do in about a minute? Get an offer for your car with TrueCar. That's right. In the amount of time it takes to floss your teeth, pet your dog, do a few sit-ups, or just listen to my voice, you can get a true cash offer. Best of all, you could do it from your smartphone or home. Just go to TrueCar and simply enter your license plate number and watch how your car's details pop up. Answer a few questions and you'll get an accurate true cash offer from a local TrueCar certified dealer. It's that easy. After that, you can bring your car in and they'll check it out with you together. You can ask questions and get the answers you need so that there's no surprises. Then simply leave with your check or trade in your car for a new ride. So when you're ready to experience a better way to sell or trade in your car, check out TrueCar today. The never-ending story is over and has been for a while, but we are just getting started talking about it here on Post-Show Recaps. And by just getting started talking about it, I mean we've already been talking about it a whole bunch here because of our Stranger Things podcasting with the season finale and the feedback podcast in particular. Never-ending story was such a huge part of the season 3 finale of Stranger Things, so we've been talking about it for a while now, but we are talking about it again all on its own podcast today. And to guide you through it all, I will be your little boy, purple buffalo hunting warrior from the grassy plain, and playing the role of my hairy flying luck dragon, it's Mike Bloom.
We are doing great, Josh.
Everything is going well. I've got a bucket full of rocks to munch on
Your hands? How would you describe your hands?
My hands are great. My hands are soft. I can't play the part of the rock creature because everybody knows I have soft hands. This is a known fact about
me. There is a thing about, you know, erosion and, you know, waves, you know, bashing rocks against each other to smooth them out. Maybe your hands have interacted with so many rocks that they merely smooth down all the rough edges to create this fantastic baby-like, almost childlike texture to your skin that you possess currently.
Now, I've only gone through the first never-ending story for the purpose of this podcast, but for the purpose of this podcast, I did do some light reading on some of the never-ending story sequels, and I believe that the rock creature's son, Junior, plays a role in the never-ending story 3, so maybe I'm like Junior's younger brother, or even Junior's son.
Oh, the third! Rock Biter the Third Wiggler is here in person.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. All right. We are talking about the Never-Ending Story as our Stranger Things adjacent podcasting continues. If you didn't listen to our Stranger Things podcasts, or if you've never seen Stranger Things before, then you may be wondering why we are talking about the Never-Ending Story in the context of Stranger Things. The lightest of spoilers, the Never-Ending Story theme song plays a big role in Stranger Things 3 and one of the more divisive moments of the recently concluded Netflix season. That Mike and I, we did a music number a few weeks ago. We have no musical numbers planned for today unless we get really wonky and wild and crazy here, Mike.
I don't know. Josh, listen, we learned from this movie that imagination is limitless. Who's to say where we're going to go in this podcast?
It's really up in the air, much like Falkor the Luck Dragon, just flying high over the great vast land of Fantasia. But as Mike and I are preparing for another new podcast that we are launching in mid-August, we wanted to do some bonus podcasting stemming out of Stranger Things 3. And the Never-Ending Story was an obvious low-hanging fruit of an option for me, largely because, Mike, I haven't seen this movie in so long. 1984, when the Never-Ending Story came out, I wasn't even a twinkle in the eye. When I guess I was a twinkle in the eye, probably, at that point. They were probably thinking about
me. Yeah, it hasn't moved down from the eye to anywhere else.
No. It's July 1984, when the Never-Ending Story arrives in the United States, and I am born some months later in March 1984. So maybe a twinkle in the eye, but barely. just a rock biter junior in the making when The Neverending Story, directed by Wolfgang Peterson, arrives in theaters in the summer of 1984. And it, even though I was not alive when this came out, Mike Bloom, you too were not alive when The Neverending Story came out, unless there's some sort of time travel deal that I do not know about regarding your past. Please correct me if that's the case.
It would explain a lot if that was the case.
Yeah, you are Asher Bloom from the future, is what you're trying to tell me.
Exactly. I'm John Connery myself, essentially.
You've John Connered yourself. But this, I don't know about for you, and I would be really curious to know your history with this movie, but this is like a nostalgia bomb for me. Like when I encountered The Neverending Story for the first time, I couldn't have been more than like 8-9 years old, something like that, and I remember loving this movie, but I haven't revisited it since I was like teens at the absolute latest. I can't remember the last time I saw it, and so much of revisiting this movie surprised me and delighted me in such a wonderful way. What's your experience with The Neverending Story?
My memories of this film are in a nice, serene location right next to a brewing of black clouds. That is to say, Josh, close to nothing are my memories about this movie. I'm sure my parents must have popped it on when I was 4 or 5, like right on that cusp of being impressionable, yet still not exactly possessing the memories to have that exist in my gray matter 25 years after the fact. I know a lot of pop culture from it. Obviously, there are things like the Swamp of Sadness. There are even totems like the Rock Biter, like yelling the child's name into the abyss, where everyone sort of has a different interpretation as to what's being said. Obviously, Falcor fist pumping, yelling, yeah, was lampooned by even Family Guy. So it's sort of like through the lens of pop culture parodies that have proliferated television in the past like 15 years that I've remembered bits and pieces of The Neverending Story. But I have to say that I had, you know, my lack of memories confirmed when I started watching this movie, just because it is plotted way, way differently than I initially remembered it. So it really made me think that I was conflating it maybe with an entirely different film. Maybe something like The Pagemaster, book-based 80s, 90s children's film.
Oh, I forgot about The Pagemaster. Yeah, that was back when Macaulay Culkin was still doing like young Macaulay Culkin things. There's like before Richie Rich, and then there's after Richie Rich is how I kind of define the Macaulay Culkin timeline. Yeah, no, he's not here. He's got nothing to do with The Neverending Story. But we do have this very wild fantasy movie that was directed by Wolfgang Peterson, released in 1984, based on a book. This is news to me. I really just goes to show how little I had thought about The Neverending Story over the last few years, that the last time I encountered it, it never would have been in a world where I was doing a deep enough dive to realize that this was based on a novel by Michael Ende, is the name of the author, and that the film actually only adapts about half of The Neverending Story and a sequel, The Neverending Story 2, based on comparing and contrasting the descriptions of the novel summary and the summary of The Neverending Story 2. Seems like it loosely adapts the second part of the book.
To the point where I believe the author even said, like, don't put my name on this thing. This is not my work. I don't know how much he was writing about, you know, racing snails and, little pervy goblins that are really interested in science and medicine, respectively.
I love the little orc. I love the little goblins. I love all of these tiny little weird creatures that populate Fantasia. It feels like such a lived-in world, and it makes a lot more sense coming from the perspective of a book, unless you're telling me that the movie just adapts it horribly wrong and gets it totally, totally wrong. But I'll take the film version. I don't need to do the deep dive into the book. The deep dive into the book via Bastion doing the deep dive into
the book.
I can just
imagine the director. Director's like, all right, so I think I got the general gist of this book. Everyone's horny for the kid, right? That's what the movie's gonna be about. Great, thank you. End days, you don't need to worry about it. We got it covered.
Oh my God. All right. So what is the Neverending Story for people who maybe have never encountered it or have not gone through it in a good long time? How would you describe the movie to those people?
It's one of our lovely movie within a movie types of stories. So the lines blur very quickly, especially towards the end. It actually is one of like the trippier children's films that I can remember, both from a visual perspective and an actual plot-based perspective. But so there's a young whippersnapper by the name of Bastion, which I will stop down for 1 second, and I will say this is one of the dumbest names I've ever heard in quite some time.
Bastion's full name, which I don't think gets uttered in the movie, otherwise it really would have pinged on my radar, or maybe I was just missing it. His full name is Bastion Balthazar Bucks. Is triple B, Bastion versus Balthazar versus Bucks.
I mean, I know we can talk later about what his mother's name is exactly, but I feel like his mother might have named him if that's the case. You know, I watched this movie with my wife and she said, okay, maybe Bastion is short for Sebastian. But I can't think, Josh, of many nicknames that are the latter part of your name instead of the former, right? Like, I feel like we can't go by like Shua and Cole are going to be talking about the Neverending Story. You know, it seems like you always think the first part of the name, not the last part.
Yeah, but I would be totally down to start calling you Ike.
Yeah, okay. You know, like Ike. Like that'll good. Be one of you.
I like Ike. I like Ike. I don't know if Osh works so well.
Yeah, you could be Oshkosh Bagosh.
Oshkosh Bagosh. Like, I never heard that growing up. Gosh.
Well, I'm just bringing back all these memories for you. Well, speaking of taunting.
It's very triggering. It's like you're throwing me into a dumpster.
Yes, or if you're watching very closely, you help yourself into a dumpster.
That's right.
poor little Bastion, as his dad curmudgeonly says, recent Emmy winner Gerald McRaney plays his father. He needs to keep his feet on the ground. He's been daydreaming too much. He's a big old bookworm who gets bullied very easily. He ends up running randomly into this bookshop to evade said bullies and meets this wise old man who he happens to just take a book from that looked kind of cool. And essentially the rest of the movie is him holing up in his school's attic reading this book, which tells the story of this land called Fantasia. It is in trouble because there's this entity called the Nothing that is essentially eviscerating certain parts of this land. And the one person, the chosen one, to eradicate the Nothing is a young boy by the name of Atreyu. And this is basically depicting his journey to help this the childlike empress feel better so that she can help expunge the Nothing from Fantasia. But of course, lots of twists and turns along the way. Many, many weird characters met, and overall, a good time is had.
A great time is had, certainly by us, maybe less so by Atreyu and his trusty horse sidekick, Artax. It's some tough times for Bastion as well. At the start of the movie, it's established that Bastion's mother has passed away at some point in the relatively recent past, which kind of makes his father being like, get your head back in the game, son. Like, that whole thing is a little hardcore. It seems like maybe your son is in mourning, sir.
Yeah, he does say, quote, we cannot let mom's death be an excuse for getting the old job done, right?
And it's very intense.
And essentially, Mr. Bucks here is essentially like exposition with a mustache, right? The entire breakfast scene is him sitting down being like, all right, Bastion, here's what's going on in your life and who you are as a character. Bye, see you later. I'm done for the movie. That's a wrap.
Yeah, Gerald McRaney, as you mentioned, plays Mr. Bucks, who has a stronger role in The Neverending Story 2, the next chapter. He is recast, as everybody is recast, for The Neverending Story Part 2, and played by John Wesley Shipp, a.k.a. The Flash from the 90s TV series, as well as the Jay Garrick Flash in the CW series, as well as Dawson's father from Dawson's Creek. So classic, iconic father figure in the sequel, not so much in this first one. He's really here just to give Bastion a hard time at the start, and that's about it.
Though, I'm going to try to make a few tenuous Stranger Things connections just to keep it Stranger Things adjacent.
No, we want that, yes.
I initially thought this guy was looking a bit Mr. Clark-ish. I think we found, like, Mr. Clark's evil brother here with the mustache and the comb-over and, you know, the sense of responsibility.
Yeah, I think he's got, like, a Mr. Clark aesthetic, and he's got, like, a parenting style of not quite Billy Hargrove's father, but I feel like he's like got like that, like hard love for your, like, you know, I expect great things from you, son, type of deal. that could be, it could be a hard thing to grow up in the shadow of that. And it seems like Bastian is really feeling it, and he throws himself into his books in order to escape his otherwise difficult existence, where he's getting pushed into trash cans. And even when he releases himself from the trash can, he encounters the bullies who say, "Hey, we didn't say you could get out of the trash can. Go back to the trash can."
Do these bullies not have other things to do? Because I can understand throwing him in the trash can, but then to stay there and monitor, like, do you think their window would originally be like 15 minutes? They're just going to stand there waiting for this kid to climb out of the trash when Bastian could very easily get out and walk the other way to the other side of that alley and they'd be none the wiser?
It feels like they've got nothing to do other than just hang out and see how long Bastian will hang out in a trash can for. But he releases himself from the trash can. He evades the bullies for most of the rest of the movie, encounters them again memorably at the end, which we will discuss because there's a lot to talk about there. But he, as Mike says, Bastian holes up in like the attic of his school. And isn't he like galvanized to do that because he's like, "Oh God, it's a math test today. I totally forgot it was my math test. I better go hide and read a book," which is like a very anxious reaction to not being prepared for your test.
It starts with that, but then it turns gradually into like, "Well, it's dark outside. Might as well not go home. I might as well stay overnight in this school, light a few candles in the attic." Josh, I'm assuming that attics in schools, I know this is originally a German tale. I don't know if that's a European thing. I haven't run into many schools personally that have attics or even more than one floor to them in elementary school.
And it looked like kind of swanky. It looked like Doctor Strange could like set up shop in that attic.
Yeah, it's a secret sanctum.
You know, like it was pretty cool. Like it's like you could imagine him doing like all like the cool like hand portally things and the on your left of it all. But that's not where it goes.
This is the one outcome where Bastian saved Fantasia. Every other time it disappeared.
Oh my God. We are invited through a portal of sorts into another world. We are transported via the never-ending story, the book that exists within the context of the movie, to visit this world, Fantasia. And it is just like your stereotypical fantasy world. There's like a little, we kind of kick it off with the rock biter as the big creature. And then there are these other people who are hanging around. There's like this little orc guy. There's this snail slug riding type of dude. There's the snail slash slug itself, which is like this weird little steed that the guy rides on. And they're all just like comparing notes and trading notes about like, "Man, Fantasia is great. And this spot of Fantasia specifically is fantastic because currently it is not impacted by the nothing, which is this amorphous force that is sweeping through Fantasia. That I guess it defies explanation. The rock biter can't even describe the nothing."
I think what this movie does really well is it does a really good job at world building, almost to the point that you're making, where there is so much weird stuff in here, but it oddly enough all sort of fits together. Like the rider of the snail looks like the Mad Hatter, so it's almost something out of like Lewis Carroll. The rock biter seems like something out of a cartoon almost. And then you have the nothing, which is almost something out of like a Lord of the Rings type of fantasy. But for some reason, it's all able to exist on its own. We, of course, have to talk about the visuals as well. This is very pre-CGI, so it's all, you know, real, authentic
practical effects.
Yeah,
there's like lots of puppeteering going on. There's of course, who we'll talk about in greater detail, Falkor the Luck Dragon. There's Gamork, which is the wolf servant of the nothing, who in my memory, Mike, I had always thought that the wolf was the nothing. I always thought that the wolf was like the physical manifestation of the nothing and not like this servant slash killer ambassador of the nothing. It turns out that that is indeed what the wolf's purpose is. So you learn something new every time you trap through here. But there's Morla, the turtle-ish ancient one.
Right out of Majora's Mask, or the climax of it in terms of like the world on the turtle's back.
Yeah, very, very odd. There's Artax the horse, who is not a puppet. That is a horse. That is a horse that drowns in a swamp of sadness.
Yeah, I didn't realize the soft pilot of BoJack Horseman was in this movie, Josh. Talking about a sad horse.
I think this is where they got the idea from. They're like, well, what if Artex got out of the swamps of sadness and had a lavish career as an actor for a time and then slipped back into an existential swamp of sadness? I think that's where the idea for BoJack Horseman came from.
Honestly, I could see a NeverEnding Story spinoff where Artax gets the R in and starts making a bunch of wishes, and one of them is to be on a very famous TV show in the 90s.
So the basic gist of what's happening in Fantasia is this terrible force called the Nothing is sweeping over the land. It's destroying the land and turning it into literally nothing. And so everybody's trying to like converge upon this this looming tower where the childlike empress rules, and she is literally known as the childlike empress. She is a child and she's an empress. So I think that they could have just gone with child empress, childlike. The like feels unnecessary to me.
This movie has so much kid bashing in it, Josh. Between, you know, Atreyu's first appearance when everyone's like, oh, you're not the hero, you're a boy. Where we got to Morla, where Morla is allergic to youth. We get the childlike empress here. I guess I understand that we're coming from a very certain perspective where Bastion is the one reading it. But I don't know. Feels like a bunch of old fogies, you know, talking down to these kids that are actually going to save the world while all they do is just sit back and glower with their various amounts of faces and heads.
Yeah, and we get a great example of that really at this point where everybody comes to see the Empress and they want the Empress to have some sort of solution to how do we combat the Nothing. He has, you know, he's like very stern and he's like, don't worry, we're going to figure this out. The bad news is the Empress is sick. She is dying, and we're gonna need to figure that out if we're gonna figure out the Nothing situation. But the good news is Atreyu, this legendary warrior who's from the great plains of Fantasia, the grassy plain where they're used to hunting the purple buffalo. Atreyu, the great warrior, is gonna show up here, and he's gonna be able to handle business. He's gonna take care of everything. And then this little boy walks through and just like struts through with all this confidence. He's like, sup, peeps? It's me, Atreyu. And everyone's like, whoa, you're just a kid. This is really funny. And Atreyu's like, all right, well, if you don't want to be in on the Atreyu business, then I'll just get out of here and go hang out with more purple buffalo. And everyone's like, no, don't do that. We need you. We're sorry for kid bashing and youth shaming you. We must trust in the fact that the purple buffalo hunting people have submitted you as their guy. So Atreyu is going to be the guy, and he's going to go out into Fantasia to find the Orin in order to cure the Empress.
Yes, well, he has the Orin. I think he's trying to find... He initially is... Basically, it's just a bunch of stops where he'll stop somewhere, and someone will say, oh, no, you should go that way and meet that person. Like, that's essentially...
Right. The Orin's like a glorified compass, basically.
Yeah, essentially. And it's basically just a bunch of... It's essentially, I go back to video games, it's one of those side quests where you like have a piece of paper and you bring it to the merchant. He's like, oh, this is great. You know what? Here's a chicken. Do whatever you want with it. You give the chicken to the farmer, and the farmer says, oh, great, here's a jewel. You go to the rich lady, give a jewel. It's like, it's essentially one big fetch quest where he's just stopping from place to place amongst this very diverse landscape to essentially figure out, you know, where he's going and how exactly he can cure this childlike empress.
And all the while, in the comfort of his little attic at the school, while the storm is raging outside, Bastion is reading along. And when Atreyu stops on the field for a snack and thinks that eating is a good idea, Bastion is there in the real world to say, no, that's a great idea, as he takes a big bite out of an apple and is just fully in the tank for everything that Atreyu's got going on.
Oh my god, what a little dweeb, Josh.
I got a great text from Mike earlier before we started recording, where I said, oh, this movie is incredible. What a fantastic movie. And Mike said, Bastion is the worst. So Mike Bloom getting a good hate into Bastion Balthasar Bucks.
Well, it's just like you could understand why he gets his ass kicked every day. Oh. Like, I feel bad saying it, but like he's so dorkily into these books, but he has such like a smug sense of self-satisfaction about it too. Of like, oh no, don't go in there, Atreyu. Like, he's one of those people shouting at the movies. And I guess his love of books is what gets him, you know, inextricably tied into this. We should also mention that he did steal a book from this old man who very specifically told him not to touch this book. He is, you know, his parents might call, his dad might say he's missing at this point. I do understand that, you know, he wants to recede into the magical world of what fantasy can provide for us. But I gotta say, the way he talks back to the book, and specifically when we get to the scene, the climax with the childlike empress, where, you know, I have to keep my feet on the ground. And he says weird things like, you know, if only she had asked me for a name, for my mother had the most beautiful one in the world. Where it's like, all right, I could kind of understand why you got bullied if you're talking like that around the schoolyard.
No one deserves to be thrown in the dumpster, but the occasional noogie perhaps would have been warranted for Bastion, who a child after my own heart. I think if I were to truly examine myself, this may come as a surprise that I think that I would be more Bastion than Atreyu. I know that sounds like that's a little dicey. I'm known for my archery skills in particular. But I think I'm more of a Bastion. I think that we both are, Mike, if we really look in the mirror.
I'm a self-loathing Bastion.
You're a self-loathing Bastion. I mean, Bastion is literally doing our job as he is reading the never-ending story and questioning all of Atreyu's decisions. And here we are questioning Bastion, questioning Atreyu's stories. He's like a pre-podcaster.
Yeah, I guess so. But that's the weird thing, is to an audience of no one. You know, then I guess, you know, I'm someone who does talk to themselves when I, you know, am trying to indulge in some pieces of pop culture. But I don't know. It feels weird being in the room with him while he does that, just because he is so energetic and animated. And then he'll have his own revelations while he'll stop and he'll be like, that's the nothing. And it's almost like a little too underlined. But I guess if we're trying to take things from his perspective, I suppose it's understandable. I don't know. This kid just creeps me out, and he's a little hammy.
Well, I think I don't know how much they're infusing this in this movie to set things up for a sequel, but I believe that Bastion's like petulant nature is actually a plot point in the future of the Neverending Story franchise.
Well, so they stop him down and they're like, okay, you're really annoying. Let's work on that.
Well, so I, you know, again, just in doing like some of the light reading on what happens in the book and what happens in the sequel movie, is Bastion is at the end of this movie, he's like granted the ability to rebuild Fantasia in, you know, whatever style he sees fit.
And also weaponize it.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about that. But, you know, but that's the thing, is in the sequel, I guess like every time he makes a wish to like expand out Fantasia, he expends a memory. So he starts like losing bits of himself.
Oh, jeez.
And this is in the book as well. And in the movie, in the sequel, it gets so intense that Atreyu, who has become like his new best friend, is like, hey, Bastion, like, you're definitely slipping, man. Like, just like relax and you're forgetting everything. And they get into a fight, and Bastion accidentally kills Atreyu.
What?
Yeah. He accidentally kills Atreyu, and it's all because like he's got like Frodo Baggins syndrome, and he's getting a little Gollum-ish. And then like he decides to sacrifice his memory of his mother in order to bring Atreyu back to life.
Wow, so this is essentially if the eating of the Lemnis bread from Lord of the Rings became much, much more violent in terms of outcomes.
Right. So I feel like Bastion maybe being like a little bit of like a I'm the best, like having that kind of thing going on about him. Maybe they're just trying to set that up for what's baked into the book already.
That's,
you know,
an
it's
interesting
this idea
point.
Of like, you know, you're the one who knows the story the best. You're the one who knows what everybody should do. But do you really? Is that what's being examined in that character? And that
or
story?
This could be one of the deviations from the book that the author was so mad about. Maybe Bastion is really supposed to be more of just like a wide-eyed optimist, as opposed to maybe this more power-hungry kid that apparently he's going to become. That really intrigues me. And I don't know if that makes me like or hate the character more, that he's going to become a murderer.
I kind of love it. I think it's kind of great. I mean, it makes a lot of sense in the context of the ending, but there's a few things that we need to set the table on before we could talk about the ending. So I know that Bastion makes you sad. So if you were to meet Bastion in the swamp of sadness, you would drown for sure, much like Atreyu's trusty horse, Artax. Atreyu and Artax are traveling through Phantasia. They're on their various fetch quests to save the land. And we hear about the Swamp of Sadness, which is this place where if you let sadness overcome you, you will drown in the swamp and you will die. And so Atreyu and Artax have decided that this is the route that they are going to go. The greatest warrior in Phantasia has decided that there is no better way forward than to go through the Swamp of Sadness. And in so doing, he gets his horse killed, Mike. Artax in I think the most iconic scene,
yes.
Maybe not the most iconic character from the Neverending Story, but the most iconic scene from the Neverending Story is the Swamp of Sadness, as Atreyu is pleading for Artax to just find some inner joy and stop being such a sad horse and pull yourself together and get out of the swamp. And poor Artax is just like staring back at Atreyu emotionlessly like a horse as he is just as he's just drowning deeper and deeper into the Swamp of Sadness until eventually there's no more. And yet Atreyu, who is the one who is expressing all this emotion, you know, very memorably got the "Artax, please, no!" He's, you know, doing the whole thing. But you'll notice, Mike, that Atreyu isn't sinking into the Swamp of Sadness. So how sad is he really?
That's a good point. Look, here's the thing. This is a very traumatic moment for kids that were watching this. Understandably so. You combine animals and death, and it's just a horrible combination. That being said, and I think this speaks much more poorly on me than the actual film itself, looking back on it, it's kind of funny.
Like in a really cheesy way.
Yeah, because it's like
a kid, this nuked me.
Yeah, oh yeah. As a kid, well, I will say actually, there's one moment actually later on in the film that actually made me much more emotional. But I will say, it's just, I don't know. It's a little funny that there's this sad horse and that this kid is screaming like, "Come on, you dumb horse, stop being sad." This is the perfect metaphor for depression. Like, do not yell at people to tell them to stop being depressed. They're just going to sink further into their swamp of sadness.
Yeah, it doesn't hold up so well today. But, you know, maybe we just, as a culture, we didn't know better back then. Back in 1984, in July 1984, as poor Artax succumbs to the Swamp of Sadness. And it really did strike me this time that, like, Atreyu just walked right out of there. he was fine. Like, you imagine in Atreyu's mind, like, that, you know, like, when he's saying, "Don't go, you're my friend." Like, is it a show? Is he just, like, mimicking what he believes human emotion ought to be?
Oh, is Atreyu a sociopath? That's a good question.
Well, that's what I was wondering. And, like, you know, later on in the movie, like, he's going to, you know, when he's going to be confronted by the Gamork at the end, and the Gamork's like, "Man, I was looking for this kid, Atreyu, and I couldn't find him, and I wanted to kill him." And Atreyu's like, "Well, if we're going to die anyway, let's just do this now. No, I'm Atreyu."
Oh, my God. I love how nihilistic he's become. Maybe there's a fragment of the Swamp of Sadness that stayed with him, even though he was able to escape from it.
I love Atreyu, by the way.
I think
Atreyu is an incredible character, and I loved his performance. I really loved revisiting the Swamp of Sadness. It does have a swamp of sad comedy about it, as Artax is no more, at least for now. And it leads Atreyu, he gets out of the Swamp of Sadness, and he finds, he gets the Morla report from Morla, the Ancient One, who is this gigantic turtle mountain thing, who tells Atreyu, like, "Oh yeah, well, you're in the wrong spot. Like, you gotta go to the Southern Oracle, and that's a very far distance away."
Specifically 10,000 miles.
"And your horse just died, so good luck, man. You're gonna have a hard time getting there." And so Atreyu, like, is like, "Ugh. That's awful. 10,000 miles is just terrible. I got to figure out how to do that." And so he leaves Morla and decides to walk back through the swamp of sadness.
Just to nail it home that he does not care about this horse dying.
He's just like, forget it. I'll just let the swamp take me. And so the swamp is about to take him, if not for the fact that a twinkle in the sky, Mike Bloom.
If you were a twinkle in your parents' eye, I was a twinkle in the sky back in 1984. Yes. That was 5 years before I was born.
As the flying albino Labrador known as Falcor the Luck Dragon decides to soar on down from the sky and swoop down and save Atreyu from the swamp of sadness. And I don't know how he got the phone call that this was like what he had to do. But he's showing up right at the exact right time to save Atreyu. And if the Swamp of Sadness is the iconic scene, then Falcor is the iconic character. Paint a picture of Falcor for the five people who are still listening to this who don't know what a Falcor is.
Imagine one of those dragons that they parade around in Chinese New Year, but someone poured a bunch of bleach on it and put it through the washing machine, but then also gave it like a weird dog-like Muppet face. And that's sort of what Falcor is. You know, I feel like Falcor is probably the most unfortunate time that the seams are showing a bit when it comes to the puppetry. You know, they can't really manipulate his lips a lot, and he can't really close his mouth. So if you did like a literal lip dub of Falcor, it's pretty much, yeah, 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 yeah. So on top of that, he's a character. He's a character in more ways than one, Josh.
He's a character in more ways than one. Mike, I believe that you pulled the audio from the entire first scene between Atreyu and Falcor that we could play right now on the podcast, just to give people a taste of Falcor and how inappropriate he is at times.
He's very Tobias Bluth, Tobias Funke, in terms of his incidental double entendres.
Yeah, so I think I would love to listen to the audio of it just like outright in one chunk if we can do that. And just to set the scene, days have passed since the Swamps of Sadness. Falcor has brought Atreyu almost the entire way to the Southern Oracle, like 9,968 miles of the 10,000 miles or something close to that number. And Atreyu is finally waking up and he's like, hey, I feel like I've been asleep for a while and I am sleeping next to this gigantic flying dog man. And I think maybe I should tiptoe away. And the scene begins as Atreyu is trying to sneak away from Falcor the Luck Dragon.
Leaving so soon?
I was just going to... I have to... I was trying to...
Sneak away?
Yeah.
He's trying to sneak away.
I mean, no, no.
I like children.
For breakfast?
I like children.
Never. I'm a luck dragon. My name is Falcor.
And my name is...
Atreyu. And you're on a quest.
How'd you know that?
You were unconscious. And you talked in your sleep.
Okay, let's pause that if we can. So Falcor has commented on the fact that he likes children, and he has been hanging around an unconscious Atreyu and has been gleaning information about Atreyu and his quest because Atreyu talks in his sleep.
All right, Falcor's canceled, right?
I think Falcor in 2019 would be canceled.
Yes, Falcor got us too'd if we're going by Morla language.
I mean, it's not okay. It's not all right. There's more to the scene if we want to keep going.
All right, here we go.
Could you get round and scratch behind my right ear? I could never quite reach it.
Having a hard time reaching his itch. So Atreyu is walking around and he's going to scratch behind the ears.
Yeah, this sounds a lot worse, just audio only.
Yes.
He's weasel. His tongue is lolling out of his weird mouth.
Oh. Yep. Not good.
That's so good. Thank you.
All right, I think we can call it there. That's Falcor and Atreyu, and it is a highly suggestive scene that is very, very strange and weird, and in hindsight, it's just very awkward. It is the basis of a Lonely Island track, Falcor and Atreyu, I forget which album, but the Lonely Island, of course, takes it a few steps further. But it's the track is basically the gist of it is Falcor and Atreyu shouting after each other as they are wont to do in the Neverending Story, and it takes a turn.
So when it comes to him being brought back to consciousness, because I'm sure Falcor would have loved to just have this kid passed out for the entire 10,000 miles and then some, but it seems like he's brought back to life from like Miracle Max and his wife's like knockoff pair of these weird curmudgeonly hobgoblin like creatures.
Yeah, I think that that's basically the idea, which is interesting because the Neverending Story, it predates the Princess Bride by 3 years. So perhaps it's Miracle Max who is the con artist.
Well, I would say that if that's the case, then the duplicate actually outshines the copy.
Yeah,
here.
I agree.
Just because I think this guy's also going to get me too, considering how much he likes to throw the word wench around to his poor wife.
He's very mean to his wife. He's a terrible husband, and he's trying to figure out how to get past the Southern Oracle that Atreyu needs to get to. He's going to need to figure out how to get past the Southern Oracle, and there's multiple trials, and there's like these two towering, basically like there's like these gigantic statues with laser beam eyes, a la Cyclops, that like you have to pass through or you just get shot. And Atreyu being a badass. And we should just like, Atreyu's a badass.
He is.
Atreyu's got skills. There's a reason why he's the number one warrior. His navigating requires some additional assistance. But he's fast on his feet.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and he has like a steadfast heart, right? That's the thing they say. This first gate will see directly into who you are as a person. I don't know if that speaks to like the childlike innocence of it all, even though he did just watch his horse drown. But yeah, he walks through this first one. The second one, he has a little bit of like the Luke on Dagobah type of thing where he looks into this mirror to see who his true self is. And that's really, you know, I think we saw a little bit of inkling of the connection between the real world and Fantasia before when Bastion, in true Bastion fashion, who I should say has been giving like Eliza Orleans-esque over-the-top reactions to everything. Like when when Falcor comes, he nearly faints, like he has the vapors. He shouts at the book at one point, and I believe Morla and Atreyu hear him. And
is there any reason why he's shouting?
No, that's the point. It's like, plus you would imagine that this kid's drawing a lot of attention to himself. I don't know how well insulated the school attic is. I'm assuming not, considering he's covering himself with a blanket later. But could you imagine like hearing a child's voice just in the school after hours? Something of a ghost story. But basically, at this point, he says, you know, if you look in this mirror, it shows you who you truly are, and who he truly is Bastion. Which is a nice little twist of things, but Bastion, of course, does not firmly believe that he is linked with this story whatsoever until the very last moment.
Yeah, so he's not quite figuring it out. But that connection is starting to be made. Atreyu is going to encounter the Southern Oracle. The Southern Oracle is going to tell Atreyu that he's got to find a human child, and this human child is beyond the boundaries of Fantasia. And so if you're like following along at all and you're figuring out that like Bastion apparently can like scream into the void of Fantasia and people in Fantasia can hear him, and we keep checking in with this kid, then that probably means that he is the human child that that Atreyu is going to need to find.
I don't know, Josh, so there's a whole sea of possibilities.
There's a whole sea of possibilities. So Atreyu is going to leave the Southern Oracle and fly on Falcor to go searching for the human boy who's going to be able to save the childlike empress. And let's pause our recap of the Neverending Story here real quick, just to give a shout out to sponsors of this episode. Support for post-show recaps for this episode of the Neverending Story. Mike, it comes from Manscaped. Manscaped. Manscaped, who is number one in men's below the belt grooming. Manscaped offers precision engineered tools for your family jewels. Now, Mike, we just revisited the fact that Falcor needed Atreyu's help in scratching the itchy spots that are just out of reach. He's got a very long body with short limbs. He can't really scratch himself. So just imagine the disasters that have occurred when he's tried to manscape himself.
For some reason, now I imagine Falcor holding a razor, and I am in all sorts of joy. I mean, considering all the hairy situations that Atreyu gets into over the course of this movie, if only he had a razor to shave through some of those.
To shave through some of the difficult spots, and Falcor certainly could use one as well. He probably doesn't even have the right equipment, but if Falcor is going to be able to lure someone into his service who is willing to help him out, he's got to make sure he's got the right equipment. He's got to make sure that he has Manscaped, because, Mike, they've got the redesigned electric trimmer. It's the Lawnmower 2.0, which has proprietary skin-safe technology, so this trimmer won't nick or snag your nuts. That's what I say. That's what you say here. No. Right now, Manscaped has a special deal for post-show recaps listeners. You can get 20% off, Mike, plus free shipping with the code POST at manscaped.com. And that means, in addition to the Lawnmower 2.0, you can also check out Manscaped products like the Crop Preserver, an anti-chafing ball deodorant and moisturizer. You already put deodorant on your armpits. Why aren't you putting deodorant on the smelliest part of your body?
There's a Big Brother contestant who's thinking along those same lines.
With Manscaped, manscaping accidents are finally a thing of the past, or a thing of a totally fictional fantasy world in the case of Falcor the Luck Dragon. So get 20% off and free shipping with the code POST at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com, and use POST. Speaking of the Southern Oracle. So let's go from there to the Sea of Possibilities, where Atreyu is flying around on Falcor, and they're in search of the child, and they find the Sea of Possibilities. And as they're flying, Atreyu kind of just recklessly drops the Orin, which is a big problem.
Yeah, listen, he's great at just, like, you know, looking at explosions as he walks away. Maybe not so good on holding on to things or navigating himself. Everyone has their weaknesses, including Atreyu.
Yeah, this is not his strong suit. It leads to all sorts of shenanigans where Atreyu falls from Falcor. He's in the Sea of Possibilities. They're witnessing the nothing, just like ravaging Fantasia.
The Rockbiter has this tragic monologue, which actually was in my opinion, the most emotional part of the movie. Maybe it's because we know more about the Rockbiter than Artax the Horse at this point, but, like, his, you know, it's almost like Shakespearean. His, like, they were big, good, strong hands. And it's just him lamenting the fact that, you know, he essentially lost all the people that we saw in the first scene in Fantasia, and he's blaming himself for it. It's pretty damn tragic.
Yeah, it is. The other thing that I have a bone to pick with the Rockbiter is, like, at the start of the movie, or at least the start of the Neverending Story sequences, he's basically saying, the nothing is sweeping over the nation, and I don't know how you even begin to describe the nothing. And it's like, I don't know, like, super scary dust cloud.
Yeah.
You know, you could probably describe the nothing. Yeah. So that's the big thing that's going on with the Rockbiter. And Atreyu is going to find Gmork, who is this wolf creature that we've been seeing occasionally throughout the movie. And it turns out that the wolf is the right hand of the nothing. That this is, like, the guy is like, oh, I love the nothing. I'm the nothing's biggest fan. I think that the chaos is going to be great. Everyone's going to be tail spinning, and I'm going to be here to just, like, lap it up. And the nothing told me that there's this little kid, Atreyu, who's out there He's trying to figure out everything to do, and he was in the Swamp of Sadness. I was going to get him there, but then some strange, unshaven luck dragon has swooped down and got rid of him, and now I can't find him, and I feel like I've let the nothing down. And that's when Atreyu like grabs like this little rock dagger, and he's like, oh, well, guess what, man? Atreyu's right here, and we should just do this right now.
Come at me, bro.
It's like he really like kind of like roids out pretty hard on Gamork.
I think he has nothing to lose at this point, right? Because I think he also sees, the nothing is literally on the horizon. So he's like, you know what? Do it. I mean, I don't know how many children exist in Fantasia, at least two. Do you think Gamork should have put two and two together and realized, hey, here's a kid. Maybe this kid is Atreyu?
Yeah, you would think perhaps. But I think that the other thing is Gamork is limited in vision.
Yeah, I would say that this scene kind of literally defanged Gamork for me, as like what I thought was like a scary creature that lurks in the darkness turns out to be kind of a bad wolf puppet that just sort of is misled and has problems with eyesight.
So Gamork is actually voiced by the same person who voices Falcor, Alan Oppenheimer, who also voices the Rockbiter.
Oh.
So the three big creature characters of the movie all share a voice.
Wow, that is very Muppet-like to have like a Frank Oz or a Jim Henson be like, yeah, you can do all those other voices.
Just getting it done. I think Gamork looks the most like a... That's a ridiculous thing I was about to say. I was about to say Gamork looks the most like a puppet. They all look like puppets.
No, I would say...
But you know what I, do you know no, what I mean? I feel like I can buy into the fantasy of Falcor and the Rockbiter a little easier than I can buy into Gamork the wolf. And I think it's because like he's recognizably a dog.
Yeah.
But like, then just get us a wolf.
Yeah, and I think that it also, it's a texture thing. Like the Rockbiter is made out of rocks, and we don't commonly encounter that. To your point, like, we see furry puppets all the time. You know, so it's sort of it allows you to sort of maybe drop your reality a bit and not envelop yourself in the fantasy as much as a giant dog dragon.
So Atreyu like calls out Gamork, and Gamork, who has no discipline, just allows itself to get lured into the trap, and Atreyu just like savagely stabs and impales Gamork. And Gamork, who's supposed to be like this tough disciple of the nothing, turns out to be nothing at all in the ring. He's no match for Atreyu, the stone-cold, Dexter-like fantasy serial killer.
Is Falcor his dark passenger?
Yeah, tonight's the night. So Atreyu kills Gamork. He's exhausted by the bloodlust and the effort that it took to kill Gamork. And Falcor swoops in and grabs Atreyu, and they go flying. And Fantasia's breaking up. The nothing has taken it all over. And now it's like they're just like kind of like flying through space.
Yeah.
And Fantasia's like asteroids now. And Atreyu and Falcor, I suppose, they could both just like fully breathe in space.
It's, again, imagination is limitless, though the limits seem to be closing. But yeah, it's a weird image to just see these little, you know, planets of foliage and to have these two just sort of floating through space. Though I guess that's what would happen if your planet broke apart, though luckily the palace still remained intact. I don't know. It has good foundations, at least for a second, until those foundations are going to break apart in a few minutes.
Yeah, so they go to the Childlike Empress's ivory tower, which still remains. The Orin gets them there. Atreyu shows up. It's like, hey, I totally biffed this. I wasn't able to do anything. I killed the wolf guy, but my horse died and I couldn't find the kid. And she's like, oh, no, you did great. The kid's totally here. And Atreyu's like, what are you talking about? She's like, oh no, he's like reading this story. What's happening to us and like what's very like urgent and time sensitive for us is just like a total fiction for this kid, Bastion, who's reading the story. And Bastion in the real world's like, what?
do you think this would have happened in real time? Like if he had left to go to the bathroom in the middle of reading, would they still have continued on without him? And by the time he could have come back, it would have already been all destroyed.
I think that that would have been the pee breaks are like during the parts where Atreyu is unconscious. So so the story kind of pauses at that point. The Childlike Empress tells Atreyu that, yeah, no, this kid's reading about us. And then there's probably people who are watching this movie about the kid reading about us.
And then there are people podcasting about the movie, about the kid reading the book about us.
And there's people listening to the podcast about the the people watching the movie about the kid who's reading the book about the people in Fantasia.
And it's all in a giant turtle.
And then there's the people who are watching the people who are listening to the podcast who are making weird faces because everything that's happening in the podcast is very strange. It really just keeps going. It's like Inception. But this is why it's the never-ending story. And so things like keep going crazy. The Nothing is now about to destroy the Ivory Tower. And the Empress is like, all right, this kid's dense. He's not getting the picture. I have to, like, actually talk to him. So she breaks the fourth wall and stares right into the camera.
Well, to be fair, the fourth wall is probably shattered at this point from the Nothing already.
She says, Bastion, listen to me. You just need to say a name. Any name. A name that you would like to give to me is what I need right now in order to save my universe. And Bastion's like, no, this is not happening. This isn't real. And the Empress is like, time's a factor, man. Come on.
Atreyu might be dead at this point. I know that's going to is something you want to do personally in a little bit, but tick-tock.
Yeah, and so like Atreyu does like biff it. It doesn't work out for him. And then Bastion's eventually like, all right, fine, I'll say it. I'll take my feet off the ground. I'll defy my dad. And I will say a name. And so he like shouts out into the lightning, a name that on watching the movie and listening to the dialogue sounded a whole lot to me like,
yes, it absolutely does. If you do not know that this name is Moonchild, you have no idea what this child is saying, including the subtitles do not even assist you in that regard. Maybe it's sort of like a choose your own adventure, like put in your own name here for the childlike empress. But apparently it's Moonchild, and it's one of those, like, Laurel and Yanni things where, like, once you hear it's Moonchild and you watch the scene back, you hear it much clearer that way.
Yeah, so he shouts, Moonchild! And then he passes out, and when he wakes up, he is in, like, a total dark universe where there's nothing but him and the Empress, who he has now named Moonchild, and the Empress is like, couldn't have just named me Julia.
Yeah. Well, I'm
confused. Sarah.
I'm confused here, Josh, because Bastion has that uber weird quote before of, what a shame they did not ask me. My mother had such a beautiful name. Was this his mom's name?
Yeah, his mother's name was Moonchild.
Okay.
I think it is a beautiful name. I
mean, I
like it.
If that's
I just think like maybe they could have like set that up a little bit better.
If that's the case, then maybe she died from getting taken in by Charlie Manson and joining his cult.
It's not impossible. So Bastion is with the Empress, and the Empress says, hey, so I've got this grain of sand. We could probably rebuild Fantasia starting here. And
it makes sense because once you get sand on you or in you, there's no way to get it out. So it's a very pertinent symbol, Josh.
So she's like, Bastion, you do it. You know, you figure out Fantasia. Your imagination is the key. You have all of these wishes that you can wish into existence, and you can build out Fantasia that way. And the part that goes unsaid in the movie, but is a big deal in the book and the sequels, apparently, is that Bastion can wish Fantasia back to life, but at the expense of his own memories. Mm-hmm. Like, he eats his own memories up and then, like, gets vengeful and kills Atreyu.
Bastion, you named this child after your own mother. Your dad said, hey, get over your mom's death. You think your first wish could be to wish your mom back, buddy?
Yeah. But his first wish is, okay, bring back Fantasia and bring me Falcor, because I want to fly on Falcor, and he seemed great. He seemed like a trip. So he goes flying on Falcor, and that's another iconic image, is the image
it's
of like Bastion on Falcor.
Yeah.
He's like, yeah! He's got the arm lifted up. To tie it back to Stranger Things, I hope that we will see some sort of flying upside down creature that Dustin befriends in the future that he's able to fly upon.
I would hope so. That would be very interesting if we had upside down creatures actually go airborne. But yeah, so we see him flying on Falcor, and then we see a very familiar cityscape And yeah, I mean, I believe Gamora...
Well, before that, he's flying on Falkor through Fantasia. He flies over Atreyu, who has Artax back.
Oh,
Artax
good.
Is alive.
Though that's going to be a really awkward conversation.
Yeah, and they're like waving at each other where Bastion waves down at Atreyu and Atreyu waves back up. And it's like, does he know who that is? Or is he just being polite? He's like, well, that guy's waving to me. I should wave back.
He saw him in the mirror, so I guess he's going to go along with that logic. Or maybe he made everyone believe in that logic.
No, that makes sense to me. You got to imagine, too, that Atreyu is like, oh, he got the flying dog and I'm stuck with the horse again.
I do love that there's a certain point where Atreyu sort of lampshades a nice moment with the childlike empress of like, wait a minute, I had to do all this, lose my horse, nearly die several times just so a kid who was reading this, who was here the entire time, was going to get to this point. And the childlike empress is like, no, he had to get to this point. But he does bring up a legitimately good point that at any point in time, this empress could have said, like, whoa, you don't need to do anything. The kid who's reading this right now can help us.
Yeah, but then it wouldn't have been as fun.
That's true.
I think, like, they need to make it exciting so that he'll read the book.
Yeah.
And stay engaged.
That is very true. We don't want it to be, like, the never-ending novella. It's the never-ending story.
Yeah, yeah, it's like the never-ending, like, paragraph. It's
a never-ending pamphlet.
Know? Yeah, you just got to go through it. But, yeah, so Bastion... then like takes Falkor. He's like, all right, Falkor, I got one more thing that I'm wishing, and it's a weird one, but stick with me. And so Bastion wishes both himself and Falkor to transport away from Fantasia and to transport back to the real world, where they then fly upon the three bullies from the start of the movie and chase them through the city streets with no regard for stealth whatsoever. It's just like a blatant all-out attack on the city with all these other like innocent people watching from the streets being like, holy shit, flying dog, alien invasion. It's like the Battle of New York in Avengers. It's like the Leviathan coming down from the Chitauri aliens.
Exactly. But I think the deleted scene is when the military came in and promptly shot down Falkor after trying to take this as like, oh, this is a sign of enemy territories. They're coming. They've manufactured dog people to come fly into our cities and take down our major metropolitan areas. I mean... Yeah, Bastion does not have maybe the strategic skills like Atreyu does, considering he's just all in it for revenge. And like you said, maybe this is a nice breadcrumb, a nice grain of sand, if you will, into a larger theme that's explored of how he's sort of like a vindictive, violent son of a bitch. But my God.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like the start of that Bastion decides like he's going to weaponize the luck dragon from Fantasia and bring it back into the real world and kill these bullies.
I don't know.
And cause like all of these other just like normal people on the street to like soil themselves in fear at the sight of a luck dragon.
As someone who was invested heavily in the early seasons of Digimon, I only know this means no good for the people, the humans that live in this world. Though maybe this could have spawned something like Neverending Story World Tour, where all these other Fantasia creatures appeared around the world, and then they'd have to interact with them in various capacities.
No, but that's not what happens. What happens instead is it's a very happy ending where the theme song kicks in, the same song that Mike and I had sung not terribly long ago, the Lamal Neverending Story. No, Dustin and Susie Poo coming in. It's the OG version of the Neverending Story blasting through the air as we are informed that Bastion went on to have many other adventures in Fantasia. But those stories are for another time. And it will produce a few spinoffs, including two film sequels. There's a cartoon of the Neverending Story. When is the Neverending Story reboot happening? In a post-Game of Thrones world, this feels inevitable.
That's what D&D are working on next, right? They're reboot after they do their Star Wars movie. They're bringing back the Neverending Story, but in a much more violent capacity.
That's terrifying to think about their interpretation of Falkor.
If Bastion's played by Maisie Williams, we know that something's going on.
Oh, no, that's cool. I'm into it. I like that. I think that's good. Well, she's more of an Atreyu.
Jack Gleason, once upon a time, could have played Bastion.
Yes, exactly. I mean, he's a little Joffrey-ish.
Yeah.
I think he's got a little bit of a Joffrey streak to him, for sure.
Yeah, I could see Joffrey. I mean, essentially, everyone in King's Landing, like, metaphorically threw Joffrey in the trash a few times. So I think it makes a lot of sense.
At least a couple of times. And that's the never-ending story, Mike.
It was just so much fun to talk about. It was so fun to watch. I mean, this ran a slim hour.
I love this movie. I want to like watch it again.
It ran a slim hour and 34 minutes, and it really just flew by. Maybe it's because essentially this was one long road trip for Atreyu. Again, I'll say the plotting is so interesting to me. I would have thought the infamous Swamp of Sadness moment would have taken place like back half of the movie, maybe even near the end, because that's the big climax. But no, it takes place in the first third of the movie, and the rest of it is just him making various stops with all these various characters. I mean, I was so interested just in the world that was built and summarily destroyed. The limits of imagination, much like was described in the film, really were just effortless. And all the various creatures and personalities that emerged were so strange, yet so interesting to watch. And you have invigorated my interest into future never-ending story sequels, considering how dark they turn. But yeah, I mean, this was also, it was a fun bit of nostalgia mixed with a nice bit of weird, which is what we like to do here on post-show recap. So it really does, again, fit that nice Stranger Things Venn diagram of like warming, you know, your heart, reminding you of a past time, but also making you say, wow, did they really do that type of stuff back then?
Yeah, they did. They absolutely did. And in the third one, Jack Black is like the bad guy. In the Neverending Story sequel, in the second one. So it's the Nothing in the first one, right? The Nothing mm-hmm. is the bad guy of the first one. In the second one, they one up the Nothing by introducing the Emptiness.
Ooh.
The Emptiness is the big bad of the sequel. And then the third one, it's the Nasty. The Nasty.
Oh, no.
And the Nasty takes the form of these new bullies that are bullying Bastion.
Do they keep recasting Bastion, or is it like we see this yes. awkwardly become yes. like 16?
Yes, yes, yes. They keep recasting Bastion. In fact, in the second one, he's played by the late Jonathan Brandis. In the third one, he's played by Jason James Richter. Of Free Willy fame is playing Bastion in round three. So Jack Black is like the leader of this group of bullies. His name is Slip, and the bullies call themselves the Nasties. So what happens is they like bully Bastion back into Fantasia. Like he's like about to get like schooled by the Nasties. He's like, I gotta dip. I gotta go to Fantasia. And so he dips and goes to Fantasia, but he leaves the book behind. And so the Nasties are like, yo, what's this book? Whoa, this book like is talking to us. And so the Nasties become like the new like god emperors of Fantasia.
Well, I'm glad they got it a lot quicker than Bastion did.
And they cause all kinds of problems. They like bring in Junior, who's the Rockbiter's son, and they go to like Mount Rushmore and stuff.
What? Wait,
yeah,
what?
I don't know. I'm just reading it off of Wikipedia.
The first one ends with Falcor taking out bullies in the middle of the city. The third one is going to a national monument with the Rockbiter's son.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. A production budget of $17 million, and at the box office, it made a cool $9 million.
Oh, man.
So that was the ending of the never-ending story. Yeah, so that's what's up. That's the never-ending story. Mike, we still have one more Stranger Things adjacent podcast to unleash upon the world before we get lost in a whole new series of things. I don't know how many more times I could just make like subtle references.
They're not subtle.
Not so subtle at all, references to what Mike and I have planned. Keep your ears out for a very specific date later in August you may want to make sure.
You may want to write it on your hand.
Yeah, you wake up in the morning and you're subscribed to Post Show Recap so that you're ready to get the thing. But in the meantime, we're just working out a whole bunch of ridiculousness on our way to a years-long journey through our next podcast. So make sure you're subscribed to Post Show Recaps on your podcast app of choice. Your ratings, your reviews, they're greatly appreciated. All of your feedback, also greatly appreciated. At Post Show Recaps is our Twitter account. Mike is at A Mike Bloom Type. I am at round, Howard. I'm ending this prematurely. We're about to begin Survivor Fantasia, right? Like, we're about to embark on a 3-hour Survivor simulation with all of the Neverending Story characters.
Well, we're about to make it 6, because then the second half of the game is going to take place in the real world with all the leftover characters.
Right. No, that's not going to happen. That's it. Anything else from you, Mike?
I'm going to actually let my friend Falcor say goodbye for me. Falcor, you ready to say goodbye?
All right, hang on tight!